Hello and welcome to the podcast of The Life Scientific, first broadcast on BBC Radio 4. I'm Jamal Khalili and my mission is to interview the most fascinating and important scientists alive today and to find out what makes them tick. My guest today is something of a rare breed, a gamekeeper turned poacher, an academic who's moved over into industry, and not just any industry, but the pharmaceutical industry. At the time, Patrick Vallance was Professor of Clinical Pharmacology and Head of the Department of Medicine at University College London, a pioneer of research into some of the body's key regulatory systems. He'd also been publicly critical of Big Pharma for, and I quote, funding studies more helpful to marketing than to advancing clinical care. By his own admission, he didn't know that much about how the industry worked until one evening in 2006, when he was asked a question over a dinner, a question that will be pivotal to his life and career. Today, he's head of research and development at GlaxoSmithKline, one of the world's largest pharmaceutical companies, with annual revenues in excess of £20 billion and nearly 100,000 employees worldwide. Since he joined, he's reshaped the way GSK carries out its research into drug development and has been behind several radical initiatives in global healthcare. Patrick, welcome to The Life Scientific.
It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So first, tell us about that evening that changed your life. What happened?
Well, I had become involved in GSK a couple of years before that. I'd been invited onto their research advisory board and I was having dinner with the then head of R&D. And we were chatting about all sorts of things, and he said, why don't you come and join? And I thought, no, it's not for me. It's definitely not for me. And then we talked a bit more, and he said, why don't you come and head drug discovery? And I went home that evening, and on the way home, I thought, am I going to spend the rest of my career trying to make things like medicines in academia, try to understand how to impact human health, and maybe be critical on the outside, or go inside and see if maybe I can be part of this and make something happen? And overnight, I made a decision that I was going to have a career change, and I'm afraid it was no more logical than that. It was a feel that I wanted to change.
And was it this, I guess, frustration with academia, slow pace, its inability to produce something concrete that would help patients in medicine, partly why you took this leap of faith?
I don't think I was frustrated at all, actually. I loved it. I loved UCL. I loved the sort of eclectic mix of people. I loved the sort of ability to go across different departments, from chemistry to biochemistry to medicine, whatever. But ringing in my ears were actually the words of somebody who I really greatly admired, which is Jim Black, who won the Nobel Prize for actually some of the medicines he discovered. And he always said, if you want to affect the lives of millions of people, you've got to go into industry to do it, because that's how you do that, through making a medicine. You can do far more there than you can on your own.
I guess much of your research has involved this amazing chemical, nitric oxide, not to be confused with nitrous oxide, laughing gas. Yeah. Can you tell me about what that chemical is, what it does in the body?
Well, it was an amazing time in the 1980s when two things happened. The first is that there was a discovery that the lining of blood vessels, which up until that point had been thought of as a sort of an inert layer almost, people realised it was doing something very active. It was controlling the way blood vessels behaved. So that was one big discovery. And then, remarkable, a couple of groups at the same time, one in the UK and one in the US, discovered that the substance being released was a gas, nitric oxide. And really surprising. I mean, it's not a gas, it's in solution, but it fundamentally is a gas. And this controls the underlying blood vessel. And I was working in the area at the time, had the great good fortune to work with the team that was then at the Wellcome Labs, led by Salvador Moncada, that was working on ways to block this.
And it had a bearing on things like cardiovascular disease.
Yeah, so it turns out that it's important for the way blood pressure's controlled. It's important for the way the blood vessel system can accommodate fluid. It's important for the way things don't stick to the blood vessel wall. And so highly relevant for everything from high blood pressure through to heart attack. And I think changed the way we think about the vascular system, actually.
And what has it led to in terms of treatments?
Well, of course, it's definitely helped understand signalling the body. I can't point at something today and say it made that new medicine, because it hasn't yet. And, you know, I think it will one day. I still think there's lots of things in there yet to come. But it shows you how long the process is sometimes of turning an idea into something that becomes a treatment.
Well, you got your opportunity to create or help create these treatments when you moved to GSK, did you feel a bit like a fish out of water?
I felt completely like a fish out of water at first. I was being like the first day at school, honestly. I mean, I didn't know where anything was and how to operate in that environment. You know, I'm sure I asked, no doubt still do, some stupid questions, and people are actually very open to sort of being able to sort of help you understand how you should be looking at something. So I think it was an eye-opener. Of course, the time I didn't feel like a fish out of water was when I was sitting down with scientists talking about their results. So that bit was great and familiar and I could do it. And I felt very much like a fish out of water as it came back up and you started to look at the totality of what was going on across GSK and the necessity to sort of move things along a pipeline, which of course isn't really a concept that you have in academia at all. So there were bits where I felt incredibly out of my depth and didn't know what I was doing, and other bits where I felt familiar, and other bits again where I thought, you know what, I can add something rather different here.
And this, I mean, let's be frank, it wasn't, and I guess still isn't, an industry that has enjoyed a stellar reputation for openness, transparency, but one that most people would say basically makes money out of people's ill health. Yeah. Was that going through your mind as well when you're making a decision? Was there any conflict?
I definitely had to think about the issues of reputation and so on. And actually, one of the interesting things for me was personal reputation versus what I thought could be achieved. And in the end, I think if you look at what's happened from the pharmaceutical industry, modern medicine and the health of the population has been dramatically improved by what's been done. So I'm in no doubt this has been a force for good in terms of what's been achieved for human health. Look at what happened with HIV. It went from being a death sentence to being a chronic disease, totally manageable. Look at what's happened to the death rates from breast cancer or the rates of heart attack, all declining, all because of medicines coming through. And then there are things where clearly it was sort of its own worst enemy. So in the past, there have been things around, you know, pricing scandals or access scandals, and that's caused damage. And transparency was definitely one of those. I'm very much of the view that if you can't repeat an experiment, and very often for a big clinical study, you can't exactly repeat that study. It's therefore important scientifically for somebody else to be able to sort of go back and reprobe it. Otherwise, it's not really science if you just do something, keep it locked and say, here's the answer. Now, you know, there'll be people who carp and say, you've gone to the dark side, you've done it for money or whatever. And there's nothing you can do about that. And that's why the sort of reputational bit, the personal reputational bit, you need to be comfortable with before you make a decision like that.
Well, your focus was on R&D, research and development, which I guess is the lifeblood of the industry. You arrived at GSK and decided R&D needed a bit of a shake-up. Why was that?
What I saw, and it absolutely wasn't a GSK-specific thing. I think the whole industry at the time had become very industrial. Process focused, how you move from A to B to C to D in a process sense with big lines doing that. And that introduced a certain efficiency and it introduced a certain way of automating things and so on. What I felt was that it somewhat undid one of the great advantages of industry, which is interdisciplinary work. You have chemists, you have biologists, you have clinician scientists all working together to try and make a medicine. So what we said was, let's try and put this together a bit more. Let's try and create groups which are smaller, more human scale, understand the mission that they're trying to pursue as a group. Many of the great ideas don't necessarily come from the, you know, most senior professor or from the head of an institution. They might come from somebody who actually has got an incredibly good idea, much more junior, and should be given a chance to run with that without being looked at the whole time.
Which is very much sort of the model of academia, academic research, as sort of this free.
It is, and I, you know, maybe inquiry. I was too influenced by that, but I think it was an attempt to get some of that into industry. But industry is different. I mean, you know, the aim is to make a product and the aim is to try and make a medicine. And you will test your hypothesis to destruction. You will know at the end of it, if you make your medicine, whether you were right or wrong, because the medicine will either work or it won't work. And that is a really rigorous form of science, in my view, to test it right the way through.
So let's explore the R&D process a little. Where do you start? How do you decide what drug to make?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's the fundamental one, actually. Where do you start? And you know, you can start with an idea, like I'd like to treat Alzheimer's disease, but you need to be much more specific as to how you're going to do that. You need to say exactly what protein in the body, for example, do I want to change its function in order to try and affect that? Really, really difficult question, and one that requires you to know, have a deep understanding of the link between that protein, human biology and human disease, and also requires you to understand if you can alter that protein with a chemical. And that's not easy. And it often takes screening of millions of molecules or making many, many variants of an antibody. And the whole idea here is to find one that's highly selective. So it just does that. It doesn't do lots of other things as well. One that actually doesn't have any other properties that means it's going to be harmful in the body. One that's got the right drug-like properties, so you're not having to take it every 2 minutes or once every 4 years because it hangs around for so long and could cause harm. So there's all these considerations on picking the molecule. Once you've selected that molecule, you've locked in all of the promise, all of the despair, all of the things that are going to happen in the future, if you like, are then cemented in that three-dimensional structure you've just chosen as your molecule. And you know, you live with the consequences of the choice you've just made.
So once you've decided on this compound, the new molecule that you're going to then pursue along this long journey to a hopefully a drug at the end, what's the success rate? What percentage of all compounds or methods you pursue end up making it to the market?
Dismal. I mean, it's a very low percentage. So well under 5% of the ideas make it through to a medicine, well under.
That's staggeringly tiny.
And it's, you know, things can fall over all the way along the line. They can fall over because the molecule's toxic, because the molecule doesn't have the right properties, because the idea was wrong, because the target was wrong, because you can't demonstrate it in the clinic. There could be many, many reasons why things fall over. But it's worth remembering, you know, when you start to make a drug, you're on a 10-year path, probably, sometimes 20. Sometimes if you're lucky, it could be 6, but you know, more often it's 10 or more. And you're looking at spending well over $1 billion to do that. So per medicine, this is a big commitment once you've decided you're going to go for it.
Why that figure? Why $1 billion? I mean, I can't imagine, you know, how you could spend that amount of money just to get one drug to market. And this is the R&D,
This is the R&D cost. And of course, part of it is you pay for the failures. So you're paying for a lot of things that haven't worked. And clinical trials are really expensive. I mean, the large-scale clinical trials that prove or disprove whether a drug works can often cost hundreds of millions of pounds in their own right, actually, to do those. You know, of course, it isn't $1 billion for every single molecule. And of course, if you stop early, you haven't spent $1 billion. But if you go all the way through and you average it, that is what it costs to get a medicine through the system.
One of the things that GSK has set up is a rare diseases unit.
Yeah.
Doesn't sound to the cynic like something a pharmaceutical company would be interested in. If the disease is rare, then by definition, there's no money in it. And it's been traditionally left to the public sector. So why was this unit set up?
Well, the reason we set up a rare diseases unit was really two major drivers. One is, well, maybe three. One is they're rather neglected. So there's a need to try and do some things there. The second is very often those rare diseases, which are caused by gene defects quite often, give you a massive insight into human biology. I'll give you an example. Let's say there's a disease, and we'll take a very rare one that we happen to do some work on called Blau syndrome. It causes skin problems, it causes arthritis, it causes eye problems. All of a sudden, you know that pathway is linked to those problems. So you get some insight into common disease. Well, maybe that's quite a good way to try and find a drug for arthritis, or maybe it's a good way to find a problem for an eye disease. The second reason that it's important is that if you think about the new technologies, whether it's gene therapy, whether it's gene silencing, whether it's cell therapy, lots of technical problems to get sorted out. If you want to use those, I think you're better off starting where you've got a devastating problem to try and fix, rather than trying to start where you've got a common disease which actually is quite complex in its presentation and perhaps milder in its overall effects. So you start with severe. So we've used the rare disease unit to A, make medicines for rare diseases, which is incredibly important for those patients, B, to get some insight into human biology and the belief this will help us also make medicines for common disease, and C, for example, use gene therapy to try and correct this, which if it works there, you could then begin to build and say, well, maybe I can use that for commoner diseases as well. So that's really why we did it. And it's been, I think, you know, a very important part of what we now do. We also work on some diseases which are neglected, which is different. So
leishmaniasis diseases.
And also the diseases which actually companies don't work on because you don't necessarily make money from them, like malaria or leishmaniasis.
And this is something called Open Lab in Spain. What was the idea behind Open Lab?
Well, we had a unit just outside Madrid in a place called Tres Cantos, which had been trying to make medicines for malaria and TB and other neglected tropical diseases for a number of years. But somehow it wasn't making the breakthrough. Now, the moment for me that was pivotal was when one of the scientists there said, I've done a screen of the compound collection, so our million compound collection, against a red blood cell with a malaria parasite in it to see which compounds kill the malaria parasite. And he said, I found 13,500 compounds in our compound collection that kill malaria. I said, what are you going to do? He said, well, we were pursuing two of them. I said, well, what are we doing with the other 13,400 and so on? And he said, well, we can't pursue everything. So we talked about it and said, well, what about if we just made all of those structures available to the academic community and said, here is a set of chemicals, all of which kill malaria parasites, and let's start a big open source project to try and see if together we can make a medicine. Needless to say, that had a few little barriers along the way with people thinking that wasn't a good idea and lawyers getting concerned about structures being in the public domain. But we did do that. And we then said, well, let's open up the lab as well. And so we've got a lab where academics can come and work and do their projects with us. Our only requirement is if you use it, you put your data in the public domain. And maybe there's a new way of doing drug discovery, which is a much more open way. And we're running that experiment. The big interesting question for me is if this much more open way of doing things turns out to be a better way to make an important new medicine for malaria, could it also be a better way of making other important new medicines, ones where actually you might also make money? And if that's the case, what's the business model that you need to put around that to make sense of that? But for me, it's a very, very exciting project. And boy, that unit is buzzing. The people there are energized and excited. The groups there work on difficult problems with others across the world. And they know they're doing something important. It's been a revelation, actually.
Now, recently, you and your CEO, Andrew Witty, took another radical decision, joining the list of organisations signing up to the All Trials campaign. The campaign was set up to ensure that all clinical trials of new drugs or treatments, regardless of the outcome, are both registered and published. Because it's claimed by organisations like Sense About Science that up to half of all trials are never published at all, which is an astonishing number. I mean, is that really the case? And if so, how is the All Trials campaign going to change it? I guess, even more importantly, why did GSK sign up?
Well, we actually have put all our trials on the clinical trials register for years before the All Trials campaign and had a commitment to publish everything. The All Trials campaign was also about making sure that the more granular data became available. And before All Trials had come out, we'd already committed to try and get individual patient-level data anonymized available to bona fide researchers. So when All Trials came, it just seemed like, well, why wouldn't we sign that? Because this is what we're trying to do.
But doesn't it seem like it's a conflict of interest to a commercial company?
I don't think so. I really don't. I think your commercial interests are around protection of your intellectual property on the molecule. That's important. Often what's called data exclusivity, which means somebody else can't use your data in their drug submission. So although it's public, they can't use it. And then, of course, your ability of how well your drug performs and how effective you are at being able to make that available across the world. Those are key things for commercial success, not am I keeping some secret? And I think that the clinical trial data in particular need to be made available. I think if I take part in a clinical trial, I expect those data to be for the good of everyone, as well as for the result of that trial.
So I just want to be quite clear here. Is this really about making all clinical trial data available to all people? I mean, if so, shouldn't it, right. It shouldn't be called all trials. Maybe it should be called all data. That would be too transparency.
No, all trials actually is not pushing for that level of data availability, and neither are we. Not least because I think there are risks in that. There's personal identification, which is a risk. There is the risk that information gets distorted before somebody's had a chance to analyse it properly, and actually that's the regulators who protect public interest and companies. And I think there's a risk of mischief making with it. So I think you do need to do this in a sort of scientifically rigorous way. I think you can't just spew out data and hope that that's a good thing to be doing.
And of course, this has already come back to bite GSK on more than one occasion. When researchers got access to the trial data involving the controversial antidepressant drug Ceroxat, they found that your company had underreported its harmful effects on young people. Isn't this the sort of thing that's going to keep happening, the legacy of all this openness?
Well, I mean, the first thing to say is that it's inevitable that side effect things will occur from time to time. And frankly, I'd rather know them than not know them. You know, in the recent paroxetine example, you know, we made sure the
which
data
is the chemical which is that Ceroxat is we, the brand name for.
We made sure the data were available to the team to go back and do the reanalysis, and they've done their reanalysis and come up with their conclusions, and the original academic who did the original study has come up with their conclusions. And, you know, this is now there for people to look at and come up to the decision. This is science. And actually, if I'm a shareholder, which I am, I don't want a company to be hiding something that might come to light. I would rather know. I'd rather get it out there. So I think the transparency, the ability to get trial data out there is critically important for the advancement of human health, and it's the right thing to do.
Let's talk about the future of R&D. We're entering, it's often said, an age of personalised medicine, thanks to genomics. What does that mean to you, and what is GSK and the industry more widely doing here?
Maybe one way to think of this is many of the diseases that we talk about are actually 19th century descriptions. And personalised medicine's way is now a molecular refining of that to say genetically it might be this rather than that in some cases. And in other cases, it's just a more advanced description based on an imaging scan. So diseases are becoming segmented. Nobody these days thinks of breast cancer as a single disease. It's a series of different diseases which need different treatments. And that's happening in other diseases as well. And inevitably, that means you can target treatments more effectively.
It doesn't sound like it would work for big pharma, creating personalised treatments rather than something, you know, a single drug on a massive global scale.
Well, you have to know that you can make that medicine at less than $1 billion a shot. And that's really right. The key. How do you then reduce the cost of doing R&D? And interestingly, those two things are really aligned because it comes back to the statement about rare diseases. If you know the cause of a disease, you've got a pretty good starting point. So the more you can be precise about what it is that's causing the disease, which is now a subsegment of a disease, the better your starting point. That allows you actually to get a lot of the failure potentially off the table to start off with.
So if you were to put a number on the future success rate of new drugs, is it likely to move up higher than that less than 5% you mentioned earlier?
It is. I mean, and I think we've got a retrospective analysis showing that actually if you start with a genetic link to your disease, you're about twice as likely to make it to the end. So let's say that takes you from 3% success to 6% success, and that's a very conservative estimate. Well, theoretically, you've just decreased your cost from $1 billion to $500 million. Now, if that's true and we can do that or even make it better, that begins to change the economics of the industry quite dramatically.
You're painting an optimistic, a rosy picture here. I mean, I'm aware that a lot of people are very worried about the future of new drugs. We're struggling to find new antibiotics, for example.
I'm definitely not wanting to paint a rosy picture on antimicrobials. I think there's a very big problem there that is a tough, tough scientific problem to crack. I'm very pleased we've got a couple of antibiotics coming through. I do, however, think, though, in terms of insights into some diseases, we are in a new golden era, and you can see that, I believe, from what's happening in pipelines and the uptick of approvals. Other areas I remain extremely concerned about. So do I believe that we are on the cusp of a whole wave of important new medicines to treat depression? No, I don't. Do I believe that we've absolutely cracked where to go in terms of schizophrenia? Not at all. So there are many areas which remain really difficult, and I don't see us on the edge of a golden era there. Others, I really do.
Would you say, Patrick, that the pharma industry would benefit from having more academic researchers and clinicians making the transition that you made?
Well, I feel very strongly that actually both sides would benefit. So, you know, one of the things that I really do think would be good is to see many more people who perhaps view their entire career as an academic one, spending a significant period in industry and going back, and vice versa. I think the skill sets, the ability to marshal interdisciplinary research, problem solving in a different way, would be hugely beneficial in some academic departments. So I think the industrial experience would be very valuable. And I have no doubt that bringing some academics into industry is also valuable, because they bring their own personal experience of the way they've done research. So I think mobility between the sectors is incredibly important.
So why have we thus far seen so little of this mobility? Perhaps academics are nervous that they will lose their independence if they moved over to industry.
I think that's true. And I think there is no doubt, you know, if your aim in life is to pursue your one idea that you really care about and nothing else, it's probably not a good idea to move into industry. I think somebody who says, actually, I'm quite interested in a number of biological or chemical questions, and I can be quite flexible on how I go about that, will have a fantastic time in trying to apply chemistry to biology, for example, and solve problems.
So I think I know the answer to this next question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Having left academic research, don't you miss all the science?
So that's a really frequently asked question, and it's so funny because I don't think I've ever done more science than I'm doing now. I don't think I've ever been involved in such a breadth of science. You know, I can spend some of one day going over raw data with a team and another part of the day looking at the sort of strategic approach to a massive clinical study. So I don't miss the science at all. I feel immersed in science, actually.
Patrick Vallance, thank you very much for sharing your Life Scientific.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast of The Life Scientific. For more information or to listen to other episodes, please search for The Life Scientific on the Radio 4 website.